Ahora sí, amigos y amigas, buenas noches, bienvenidos a Vandalismos. Esta tarde calurosa, aquí ya de noche, pero aún está claro. Y hoy tenemos un fondo lluvioso para refrescar un poco la onda de calor que azota acá. Y esta noche voy a compartirles un libro bien chulo. Vamos a leer en inglés un rato a Liz Green. Liz Green es una astróloga que estudió a Jung, estudió muchísimo el trabajo de Jung. Ella misma es una analista junguiana y pues tiene unos trabajos alucinantes sobre astrología y deep psychology. Y pues tiene un libro bien chingón que se llama Jung Studies in Astrology, Prophecy, Magic and the Qualities of Time, que fue publicado por Routledge. Y pues es del 2018, pero ella ya de hecho publicó antes un análisis astrológico sobre el libro rojo de Jung. Así que, pues sí, disfrútenlo. Es en inglés, pero me encanta. Y bueno, ella, todas las citas que tiene de otros astrólogos o de alquimistas, o de hecho las encontró exclusivamente, o sea, usa únicamente los de la biblioteca de Jung en su casa, ahí en Küsnacht. Y pues, entonces ella usa citas que encontró en el Collected Works. Y sí, la introducción es por Sonu Shamdasani, que es pues un especialista del trabajo de Jung. Él mismo no es analista, él es historiador, da clases de historia de la medicina in the UK. Y también es especialista del libro Novus y del libro rojo. Y bueno, vamos a saltarnos esta introducción, pero la de Sonu Shamdasani, pero vamos a agarrar extractos de lo que es. Como tenemos nada más apenas una hora, más o menos, entonces nomás vamos a agarrar ciertos párrafos así de manera sincronicidad, así al azar, al oráculo. Y bueno, pues que les gusten, amigos. Ecstasy or visions begin when thought ceases to our consciousness to proceed from ourself. It differs from dreaming because the subject is awake. It differs from hallucinations because there is no organic disturbance. Lastly, it differs from poetical inspiration because the imagination is passive. That perfectly sane people often experience such visions, there is no manner of doubt. William Rolfe Ing. The spirit of the depths from the time immemorial and for all the future possesses a greater power than the spirit of this time, who changes with the generations. The spirit of the depths has subjugated all pride and arrogance to the power of judgment. He took away my belief in science. He robbed me of the joy of explaining and ordering things, and he let devotion to the ideals of the time dine out in me. He forced me down to the last and simple things. Carl Gustav Jung. Some domains of knowledge are easily distinguishable from each other, archaeology, for example, or zoology. Other domains, like medicine, are also easily identified, but so broad that they require further clarification through subdivisions. Such as gynecology, cardiology, and orthopedic surgery, still other domains are resistant to any precise definition, even with a myriad subdivisions, and may be viewed as liminal. Liminal subjects tend to spread promiscuously through the interfaces between disparate spheres of study, such as religion, psychology, and magic, which are themselves notoriously resistant to any universally agreed definition. It is this enigmatic borderlands of human explorations that the historian Otto Neugebauer once called wretched subjects. The manner in which Jung investigated, adapted, and interpreted astrology, one of the most historically significant and enduring, as well as one of the most poorly understood of these liminal realms, forms the subject of this book. Scholars like to know the names of things and the categories to which they belong. To this end, they have devised academic constructs such as Neoplatonism, an appellation first created in the late 18th century to describe the religious beliefs, philosophies, and practices of a group of individuals living between the 3rd and 6th centuries in widely disparate areas of the Roman Empire, with differing cultural denominators. These individuals never called themselves Neo, but were attempting in their own unique ways to interpret Plato's work according to their personal perspectives and experiences. They shared a love of Plato, ideas, and a conviction that there was still a great deal between Platonic opus and the merited for their elucidation. Neoplatonism is a useful category because it locates these individuals between a wrongly identifiable time frame, a more or less recognizable philosophical system, and a broad cultural context. But as a definite level, Neoplatonism can obscure the enormous differences between the ideas and doctrines promulgated, for example, by Plotinus, whose Aeneids exercised a lasting influence on Christian theology, and Iamblichus, the head of the Platonic Academy in Syria, whose text of Theurgy, The Mysteries, was particularly attractive to the occultists of the late 19th century. Likewise, Neoplatonism can obscure the enormous differences in the interpretation, or, as it is currently understood, the reception of these authors from the time of their writing to a present day. Another example of an apparently precise but highly misleading academic classification is the term Renaissance from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century. It seemed perfectly clear to historians what was meant by the Renaissance. It spanned the period between the early 15th and mid-17th century, filled by the translation from Greek into Latin of classic and late antique texts, once lost to the West, but made accessible through the fall of Constantinople to the Ottoman Turks in 1453. The Italian Renaissance, viewed from this perspective, represents a dramatically sudden, spontaneously generated rebirth of ancient pagan philosophy and art in Western Christian context, epitomized by the paintings of Botticelli, Da Vinci, the sculptors Michelangelo, the Platonic Hermetic philosophical elucidations of Marsilio, Ficino, the Kabbalistic explications of Pico della Mirandola, the poetry of Petrarch, Boccaccio, and Angelo Polissimo, and the scientific genius of Galileo and Copernicus. It is also heralded a resurgence of the three occult sciences of antiquity, astrology, alchemy, and magic, which were later to prove so fascinating to Jung. But this definition of Renaissance has been contested between the academy for more than 50 years, a period of great religious and scientific expansion between 1050 and 1250. Is now referred to as the 12th century Renaissance. Unlike the later Italian Renaissance, it also involved the importation of texts on magic, astrology, and alchemy. this time from the Jewish and Muslim worlds of southern Spain and the Middle East. The Italian Renaissance is now seen as an inevitable outgrowth of the 12th century Renaissance, enhanced by the development of printed books, which eventually led to the Reformation and what is now known as the early modern period in Western history. Categories such as early modern may themselves over time be reviewed and revisited. The historiography of any place or period of human culture and any genre of human creativity is as revealing and complex as the history itself. Many people outside the academy have no difficulty in identifying themselves as religious, but scholars continue to argue ferociously about the definition of the term religion, according to criteria that may mean nothing at all to those who firmly place their trust in the ineffable through direct experiences, but never enter a collectively recognized place of worship or call their divinity by a conventionally acknowledged name. Because many of these individuals have no intention of ever setting foot in a church, chapel, synagogue, mosque, or temple, their perspectives are deemed to be either New Age cults, as is the case with many contemporary spiritualities, or part of the modern process of secularization, another constructed category like Neoplatonism, which serves the purposes of the academy but does not faithfully reflect and may even grossly misinterpret the highly individual ideas, beliefs, experiences, and aspirations of those grouped under such labels. Even the term modern is open to question. We may think of ourselves as modern and speak of modern world or even the postmodern world. Psychology is understood to be modern science, astrology in contrast is deemed to be pre-modern, and its indestructible popularity has continued to baffle sociologically inclined researchers. But is modernity a precise period of history that began at the time of the Enlightenment? Another academic construct. At the end of the 18th century, is it modernity an evolutionary step in social progress or a regressive one? Is it the product of industrialization, secularization, science, or disenchantment? Is modern a perspective that has occurred many times in history, perhaps in a cyclical fashion, reflecting a certain way of viewing reality? Or does modern simply refer to a fluid category which people have used through history, albeit under other names, to differentiate themselves from a perceived primitive past? Academically constructed categories, even when they implacably disagree or are subject to constant revision, are useful, not least because in a scholarly work, it is advisable to make oneself understood by stating clearly what one means by a particular term. But these categories must necessarily remain hypothetical and fluid, because no two cultures and no two individuals will ever precisely agree about what constitutes religion, magic, or psychology. Astrology, too, usually perceived by historians as a monolithic entity under the rubric of divination, needs to be understood as a pluralistic cultural product. There have always been many astrologies in terms of the diverse cosmologies, philosophies, techniques, modes of interpretation, and material and spiritual applications developed by astrological practitioners. Also, the symbolic representations of Western astrology have remained relatively consistent over many centuries. Jung's psychologically oriented astrological approach is very different from the Aristotelian astrology of Ptolemy. totally mean in the second century, which in turn differs from the magical astrology of the adepts of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn in the late 19th century, and the theosophical astrology of Alan Leo in the early 20th, rooted in Madame Blavatsky reinterpretation of Neoplatonic and Gnostic ideas about the spiritual evolution of the soul. In recent decades, cultural specificity has become a powerful tool between the academy for ensuring that scholarly definitions of the sphere of human activity, such as religion, remain fluid. But at the same time, these definitions are paradoxically expected to provide clear and stable boundaries between discrete areas of human experience that may be more subtle, interwined than at first perceived. For example, one can be a psychologist of religion, but it is not easy to be a psychologist who is overtly religious without risking a loss of credibility in the eyes of those who view psychology solely as a science. Sonu Shamdasani has pointed out that much of the controversy surrounding Jung's work rests on the fact that he was one of the most prominent modern psychologists to affirm religious values. One can be a scholar of magic or a scholar of astrology, yet one cannot practice ritual magic or astrology without serious questions being asked about one's academic empiricism, even though it is problematic and perhaps even impossible to discuss such fields intelligently without any direct experience of them. As Shamdasani states, Jung's non-derisive attention to such subjects was enough to brand him as an occultist. When non-derisiveness leads to direct experimentation, as it did with Jung, genuinely relevant questions such as what valuable psychological insights may be gained from such experimentations are not asked by critics. Prejudged and uninformed opinion and even personal hostility may replace methodological agnosticism and the testimony of individual experience. Even figures from the ancient world can suffer from this kind of anachronistic imposition of present-day cultural paradigms. The reputation of Iamblichus, who was labeled a magician by the religious historian E.R. Dodds in the mid-20th century, has never entirely recovered from the assumptions that rational philosophy and theurgic mysticism are mutually exclusive. Iamblichus is still, despite recent scholarly efforts in the last two decades, viewed by some academics as a depraved occultist. As Seki Mathur has pointed out in a paper on the magical roots of Platonius' rational mysticism, much of the previous scholarship has consciously or unconsciously assumed that magic is a category radically distinct from both philosophy and high religion. And while the rehabilitation of theologically inclined Neoplatonists such as Iamblichus is finally being pursued, and in some quarters, this kind of common sense neutrality does not always extend into the domain of academic psychology. The work of psychologists and psychotherapists who spend too much time exploring the liminal zones does not often meet with an unbiased reception. In the world of wretched subjects, precise categories tend to dissolve, merge, and mate with each other to generate new hybrids. The insights gained from direct experiences may prove as important as intellectual analysis and scientific methodologies, and blurred boundaries are the norm. However disturbing this may be, ideas with enormous agency and longevity can be seen in their most dynamic forms. while they are still in the process of transforming and creatively adapting to particular cultural milieu, but have not yet been bludgeoned into the codified inertia by the requirements of specific academic, socioeconomic, and political concerns. Wretched subjects, however, plentiful and important, the documentary evidence still form an academic wilderness, relatively unexplored until very recently, in which there are no neat, inarguable rules for scholastic methodology or religious ontology. This can prove uncomfortable, and the temptation to turn the wilderness into a careful manicure garden through the application of intellectual secateurs, herbicides and insecticides is sometimes irresistible, but it is only when these spheres are explored from within as well as without that genuinely creative thinking is possible. Jung spent a great deal of time in the liminal interfaces between psychology, religion, and psychology and magic, magic and mysticism and medicine. Like any individual, he was vulnerable to the dominant values of his time and his culture, and he suffered enormously each time he ventured beyond the barbed wire fence surrounding and protecting his chosen profession of psychiatry, and sought psychological insights in what are now understood to be esoteric subjects. It is unclear whether the subjects Jung studied are indeed esoteric. This depends on how the term is defined and in which historical period the definition has arisen. Astrology is often considered as an esoteric sphere of study, but until the end of the 18th century, it was mainstream, and despite continuing efforts to obstruct its practice or challenge its legitimacy at various historical junctures, it has remained an intrinsic, albeit sometimes covert, aspect of the religious cosmologies of both East and West. Many of the subjects which Jung studied blend different spheres of human experience. Art serves as an instrument of magic. Astrological symbols yield psychological insight. Dream image open gateways to religious experiences disguised as madness. God and the unconscious become indistinguishable. Medicine joins hands with shamanic rituals, and sexuality is a holy magical rite. However, the label esoteric can be comforting one for scholars because once this term has been given fixed boundaries, it is no longer necessary to tolerate the uncertainty of whether what Jung did was psychology or religion, or whether attempting to distinguish between the two may be asking the wrong question. In the view of many academics, Jung was not a proper psychologist, but rather an esotericist with a religionist bias whose works is rooted in the German Romanticism of the 19th century. That apparently places him safely in a recognizable category, where until very recently it was assumed that, like a tricky gin in a bottle, he will quietly remain. In autumn of 2009, a new work by Jung titled The Red Book, Liber Novus, was finally released for publication. Close to the time of his death in 1961, Jung made the following comments about the period of his life when he was engaged in creating Liber Novus. The years when I was pursuing my inner image were the most important in my life. In then, everything essential was decided. It all began then. The later details are only supplements and clarifications of the material that burst forth from the unconscious and at first swept me. It was the prima materia for a lifetime work. Liber Novus, known as the Red Book, because of its leather binding is Jung's calligraphic revision of a series of private diaries known as the Black Book, covering the period from 1913, the time of his break with Freud, to 1932. The work is both textual and pictorial. Virtually every page contains a painted image, all of them strikingly beautiful and impeccably executed, and the calligraphic writing mimics a medieval illuminated manuscript. The dominant narrative of Livernovus is Jung's journey from alienation to the restoration of his soul through the long and painful process of integrating a rift between his own nature, the seemingly irreconcilable conflict between reason and revelation, outer and inner world, subjectivity and objectivity, and between the scientists and the religious visionary, both of whom he experienced as authentic, demanding, and mutually exclusive dimensions of his own being. The existence of Livernovus has been an open secret. Once Jung's autobiographical memoir, Memories, Dreams, Reflection, was published in German in 1961 and in English in 1962, as he described the genesis of Livernovus in this work, and unpublished copies of Livernovus had been circulating among Jung's close colleagues for some time, but it had never been accessible to the wider reading public, nor even to the majority of analytical psychologists outside Jung's own intimate circle. Now its publication has inspired a proliferation of books, articles, workshops, interviews, lectures, and commentaries ranging from reviews in newspaper, internet seminars, and interpretation in analytic journals to the website of modern pagan groups, one of which, with considerable justification, declared online that Livernovus is the most important grimoire of our modern age. Jung's reputation in the world of clinical psychology has always been ambiguous, often viewed as a mystic, or even in the view of Freudian analyst D.W.V. Winnicott, a schizophrenic who somehow managed to heal himself. Jung's theoretical models have been deemed questionable because they are insufficiently scientific. It is difficult to demonstrate through repetitive experiments the existence and location of the archetypes of the collective unconsciousness. Current paradigms of clinical psychology tend to favor cognitive approaches to the human mind, which are more amenable to the methodologies of the natural science. According to David Tacey, a professor of psychoanalysis at La Trobe University in Melbourne, one of the reasons why Jung has been marginalized between university psychology department is that his work does not fit any specific academic discipline. Staff in psychology are likely to refer to it as religious studies. Surprisingly, the view of Jung as unscientific has also been promulgated in the academic sphere as of esoteric studies, an area of scholarship that has until quite recently itself been marginalized, and where one may reasonably expect a more methodologically neutral and practitioner-tolerant approach. But